Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. Kojo Regal is a singer-songwriter born and raised in Trinidad. His music has a reggae sound with a melting pot of genres, including soca, dancehall, R&B, and pop music. He found his voice in Trinidad writing with his friends, and in 1989 they formed a boy band inspired by Boyz II Men called New Creation, writing and singing their own songs. They became an overnight sensation, leading to the album Spirits of Gold, released in 1998. Kojo later moved to London to further his music career as a solo artist. Working his way from the small stages of Trinidad to working with some of the world's biggest artists. After moving to London, Kojo worked as a respected A&R scout for Craig David's producer Mark Hill at his Stoosh Records imprint. He has collaborated with a number of artists including Jethro, Lone Star Sheeran, Kay Warren, MC Vapor, Audley Anderson and Risky Javan. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Kojo Regal. Where do we find you in the world? How are you doing and what's happening in your life?
You find me in London, East Acton, London. You know, it's the west part of London. Yeah, I'm happily residing here with my wife and kids. And
let's rewind to the very beginning of your journey in the entertainment industry. So at what age, whether it was a child or teenager, did you decide, cool, this is my path? And how did that accumulate to where we are currently? So your entertainment industry journey.
All right. Well, I never knew when I was listening to rap music that I'd be an entertainer because, you know, I found myself, you know, listening to and the vibes of like early rap when it came, well, not when it came out, but, you know, just like just when I found myself listening to it was like listening to like LL Cool J and Slick Rick and stuff like that. And fiddling with it, trying to rap, you know, my own little raps and stuff like that. Sometime in my life, my mother bought me like a keyboard, you know, and, you know, I was wowed by, you know, just having a bit musical instrument in front of me. I dabbled with it. It was a kind of a Casio keyboard type, you know, so, you know, just kind of play with the tones and, you know, first thing I taught myself to play was like Axel F. And I didn't have much musical people around me. So, you know, I just kind of like think about, you know, just whatever things that came across my path, you know, like Aha, you know, Pick on Me and those singles, you know, was kind of like what kind of came my way to kind of learn to play easily. Because I live in St. Anne's, which is it's in Port of Spain, Trinidad and Tobago, where I was born. We had like some guys that I used to play football with. They would come past my way, go into like a neighborhood called Cascade, and they would be going on this kind of mission that was a musical mission, I heard, where somebody was putting together a group. And I kind of being very inquisitive, tried to find out, you know, more and more about, you know, what they're up to, you know, because, you know, I played football with them, but then they had this other activity going on. Like, oh, what's this thing you're trying to do? You know, like, it's, you know, you're singing or something like, and this guy, he had like a kind of, he was a church going guy, but he was trying to help them form a sort of a cappella type, doo-wop type singing kind of thing, you know? So I followed him one evening and asked the leader, you know, at the time, his name was Kevy. And I said, yeah, can I get a hang, you know, a little bit? I got a keyboard, you know, he just come and, you know, see if I could kind of just jam with you a little bit, you know? And he said, yeah, come along. And, you know, so I came there, not being a real musician really, you know, but I came with my keyboard in hand and I said, you know, I just kind of pal with you all and see, you know, see what you're up to. So he was trying to teach him a little bit about Boyz II Men and you know, this is the groups at the time they were going, you know, that they were up like you know, the acapella and the so like the soul groups were like Jodeci and the Men and stuff, and you know, so the ideas were kind of there what they were trying to do, but they were actually learning church songs, you know, that like acapella. Everything the guys, his name is David, you know, David Paris, everything he was trying to teach him was kind of in line with being in sync with singing for church reasons, you know, because he was kind of a gospel head, and you know, to the idea was he was teaching them church songs and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we being, you know, young and impressionable, you know, we love what was going on at the time, and we didn't move away. We learned the church songs, you know, and we went out and sung a little few church songs. But we started getting into Boyz II Men and singing, you know, some of those, you know, those harmonious type of R&B, you know, things were happening at the time, you know. So yeah, from there we went on to like a few competitions on TV, and you know, the girls started to get to know us. We became a little popular with the, you know, the, you know, the in crowd and stuff like that. And we, you know, we tried to, you know, be the cool boys that we were. You know, the group was called New Creation, And, you know, we became very popular in Trinidad and Tobago, as TV sensations, you know, who could sing a cappella and do doo-wop type of things. We didn't win the top competition, but which was called Party Time, but, you know, we were well known now. And, from there, I kind of pushed the border and said, hey, I kind of learned a little bit of a rapping. Why don't we kind of learn to rap this song that I wrote, you know, because I was like drumming in schools and stuff and just making up my own raps and stuff like that, you know, but didn't really learn how to write then songs and stuff. But, you know, I just kind of just fiddled with rap. That's what kind of came out of me easily at the time. And one thing led to another. We had a demo. Before you know it, Eddie Grant heard the demo. And then he gave the group a recording deal. And
Wow.
we flew to his place in Barbados and started to record an album.
And then how did that progress? So you recorded the album, and what were the next steps?
We recorded the album. Eddie Grant and his business manager, Mike Dolan, fell out. They had a massive court battle, right, over the label that they started, Ice Records. Yeah. I mean, Eddie went his way and Mike Dolan went his way, you know. At the time, we didn't really know who Mike Dolan was, but I got to know him in the end because what happens, we were signed to Eddie's label, but out of a deal, our manager made a decision to opt out of the deal. We had already recorded an album with Eddie Grant. We spent a lot of the time living at his house, you know, wined and dined by him. It's a lovely place in Barbados. And then only to find out that we're now opting out of that deal. It was unknown, unclear to me the reasons why, because we were teenagers at the time, you know. He just asked us, you know, what do we want to do? And we just kind of said, okay, well, all right, your decision's the best, you know. We got out of the deal only to re-sign to Mike Dolan, his business partner, a competitor, right? We re-signed to his label in the UK, and we came over to the UK and re-recorded the whole album from scratch. Yeah, the exact album. I don't remember if we added an extra song, but we did record one extra song. But I'm not sure if it was on the album. But anyway, the fact is, we did the album over in London. I think that's why we wanted to come to London, because we had recorded a cover of Hey Jude, which is a kind of synonymous with the Beatles. And with the loss of Eddie, we wasn't sure if we could re-release or release the album in UK. I think it was might have been US territories, and we kind of felt a little bit aligned to UK. And so Mike Dolan, the deal might have appealed to my manager more, and we came back here and recorded it. After that, we went on a UK tour. UK got to know us. The single blew up. You know, it got into the charts of the Box, which is one of those big competitive TV stations at the time. The video was amazing. It was done in Tobago. You know, it was great. You know, showing up a sunny side to the Beatles, Hey Jude. You know, it was reggae. You know, we were young and Caribbean, and it was really, really beautiful. R&B and reggae mixed up in one. You know, coming from Trinidad and Tobago, it was a great start for us, and yeah, brought me here to the UK.
So how long were you with the group for, and when did you become solo?
Came to the UK, and we sort of like finished our entry into the UK around 1999. The group, we were back in Trinidad trying to figure out our next steps, you know, as we finished the album and the tour and everything. And management was kind of like we was kind of at arm's length with management, because we're like, we were kind of, you know, as groups do, you know, the kind of like, you know, issues develop, and you know, they have questions about how things are done and stuff like that. So we all decided that we wanted to do it sort of our own without the manager. And we went to America, which a manager was courting us in America to come in and maybe look into a new deal, new option. We were R&B bound, so we thought, why not go to America? We got there and we started being courted by different labels and stuff like that. And but unfortunately, the lead singer, he didn't really gel with the street nature of the management, you know. And he thought it was really rough edged and unlike how we were looked after in the UK and stuff like that. So he sort of made a decision to, you know, to leave, well, leave or not cooperate. And that kind of put us in a predicament. We couldn't do anything in the US because our lead singer, we depended on his, you know, his talent, right? I wasn't really a lead singer per se, you know. I was just kind of like writing, and you know, that was my ideas, but I kind of spearheaded the US movement. We came to a stall, and I decided, okay, well, I'll come to London and look into renewing our second album option deal. Yeah, the label was very much in talks with me, and they saw me as a communicator for the band. So I said, I'll come to London and see if we could work up a second album. I got here within 2 months, and it came a phone call that one of our guys died in a car crash in
No shame.
New York. I don't know. It was the worst thing that ever happened. The group were lost. You know, we were disillusioned. I was here in London. and nobody knew what to do. And I was, very young at the time, and it just kind of like, it was a whirlwind of events. In Trinidad, we were such a big band in Trinidad, and was catastrophic. To what we did in Trinidad was very different to what Trinidadians do. They make music that's calypso and soca. We made a blend of music that combined some of that, but we were headed towards R&B and pop. The first record I released was sort of calypso soca oriented, but I rapped on it, so it was very different from what calypso and soca normally is. They sing, I rapped a single, and it was like, whoa, it was very most different thing that came out of Trinidad, we were kind of revolutionizing music. So when death of our member Rocky, we really wouldn't sure how to come up from that. I stayed in London somewhat as a result, but it's kind of like it was a place for me to find myself. Oh, my wife was my girlfriend at the time. She helped me through it. It was the toughest period of my life. It took me a long time to get over it. I really wasn't sure what I was doing for a long time. I started to get into music somewhat through my uncle-in-law. He had a record shop. His name's Smokey Joe. He's kind of a reason. He kind of nurtured me through the music game a bit, because he was working in the record business. He put out records, for a long time. But they were mainly soca records that he invested in. But because he knew the nature of the business, I think he kind of took me on his wing. My dad passed away, so I didn't really have a father figure. So Smokey was kind of like indirectly involved in my life, because my wife was, my first person to go to. She was my girlfriend at the time. But somewhat Smokey was always kind of like influential from the side. I didn't realize how important he was until, now I realize how close we are and how much we do together. But I walked through the industry trying to figure out what do I do with my talent. The label was still kind of there, but we didn't have nothing to go on because the group wasn't there anymore. So I kind of like tried to think, oh, well, should I learn to produce? Should I learn to, should, I can write, but should I learn to produce? I tried, I had an ear for music, and I started to listen to what is A&R. And I sort of found myself trying to incline myself to be an A&R person. I always admired the A&R people, Simon Cowell's, and the greats, Puffy, and the guys who had ears for listening to music and discovering what's talent. And I was like, trying to learn, okay, what, how to be an A&R scout. Eventually, I found myself working my way in the hands of being an A&R scout. I saw a record that came out when I came to London. It had the name of a producer who produced a remix for Craig David, who's big in the UK. When I came to London, I didn't really know what Garage was, and the first single that I remember hearing coming out of the airplane was Rewind by Craig David. I thought, what is this music? I was like, this is really weird. But anyway, it was what UK was built on for urban music at the time, and from there, I was lucky to see a telephone number. I remember it in my head literally now, like when I saw it, like, who puts telephone numbers on our CD, and I saw the guy's name, and it's like Niraj Shah, and like, there's a number, I gotta call it. I was like, yo, so I just that gut thing, and I like, so I called it, and Niraj responded, and he said, hey, I said, I'm Kojo, I come from Trinidad. I gave him a little bit of a story. I said, I can rap, and he said, okay, come up to my studio. But at the time, I was not just I was well past rapping. I'd learned how to write songs, because I had to write for the group. I had to discover how to write everyone's vocal range, and I made the worst demos trying to mimic, the singers in the band, because one sound like Johnny Gill, one sound like Michael Jackson, one was like the bass man from Boyz II Men. I had to learn everybody's voice range and write for them, yeah, and that kind of forced me to learn how to sing. My demos were awful. They used to laugh at me, but through that I learned how to sing. I'm a good singer now, I would say, but back then I was like, whoa, these demos, I couldn't even listen to myself trying to make these demos. It was the funniest time. But but anyway, when I spoke to Niraj, I said, hey, I could rap, because I wasn't leaning on my voice as a singer yet, as an independent artist. I was like, I think I know how to rap. I can write lyrics and stuff like that. So Niraj said, come up, throw demos at me, and we became great friends. And eventually said he's starting a label. It's called Berserk. Okay, what do you want? He said, I think you're kind of ears to the street, because I was going around looking for clubs to sing and do open mics at the time. And he said, maybe you can find me some acts and stuff. I said, okay, cool, I'll try. And eventually I found a few things that I thought was interesting, and I brought it back, and he said, hey, you know what, this one guy, I like. And then there was a group that I found called Case Closed, and it was like, he's really liked this group. I didn't know that Nuraj was actually working for an offshoot of Mark Hill, who's the producer for Craig David at the time, because they were good friends. They come from Southampton together, and it was like, you know, studio buddies, and and they hung out in some Southampton, but Southampton is like miles away from London, and so I never, you know, clued up that Nuraj came from the garage background, the garage scene background, you know, because he was living in West London. Anyway, so when I discovered the band Case Closed, he said, "Oh yeah, I'd like to try and show them to my partner, Mark, right?" And then he said Mark Hill, and I was like, "Well, Mark Hill's name was big at the time because you know Lucian Grange was courting him as a producer because he did so well with Craig David. You know, by that time Mark was working with like J Lo and stuff like that, and Christina Milian, and you know, great big singles and stuff. So when I looked like, you're working with Mark Hill. Wow." He took that demo that I found for Case Closed, and he took the demo and he signed it to the label. The label was called Stush Records. I was happy that I made that discovery and, you know, the sign in for Mark Hill's first label that he started off, and you know, I discovered the first act, you know. Funnily, they didn't go too far. You know, they signed it. They started getting to demo making and whatever. I don't know. They got into management issues and just, you know, as much as they were signed and announcing Music Week, as they were signing to Mark Hill, no sooner as, you know, if this is the way that's done, you know, and like, okay, well, that deal was over. But it was me and my A&R kind of props. I was like, hey, you know what? Hey, maybe I got good ears, you know? So I moved on, but me and Nuraj, we're still good friends to this day and stuff. I found myself in another little sort of label situation where my wife's cousin, she introduced me to some guy she was messing around with. They formed a label called Perumbe Records. And I was like, you know, hungry to be in the business, you know, of music and stuff like that. Totally ignoring the fact that I have my own talent. I was just like, you know, just trying to be A&R and stuff. Got myself into this, you know, little kind of scenario. Okay, Perumbe, they're looking for a guy. Next thing you know, hey, I'm A&R director. I'm like, whoa, title, A&R director for this label, Perumbe Records. Whoa, you know, with salary. I'm like, okay, this is great. It was cool. I mean, it was like in the East End of London, Essex, and I was like happy to just make a great discovery in an artist that was already doing well on a underground level in, let's say, drum and bass and garage, right? He's an amazing rapper, and his speed that he rapped and so eloquently, I was like, I have to sign him. His name is MC Vapor. He's very notorious, you know, this day in rap and stuff like that. You hear him, his talent's amazing. I was happy to have an involvement in, I wouldn't say discovering him, because he was already, you know, kind of sort of semi-known, but you know, just not invested in, you know. And I had this deal where I could help him, you know, and I said, you know what, I gotta invest in him, he's great, you know. So we put the money down and we invested in him, trying to get him, you know, people to make a great album. And you know, he spent, you know, quite a while working with us and great making records. And you know, I got him out and got a first video out, and got him all the press, and you know, and you know, helped made him visible. I couldn't say I helped make him a star. I mean, he went on to do his thing, but I did give him a lot of good press and get his face out there, and you know, help make him notorious. And I'm really happy I had a hand in his career. You know, we're still cool as, you know, as well now. And then eventually, walking away from A&R, I found myself working for a reggae label called Jetstar Records. And it was in this scenario that I ended up singing again, because what happens, like, Jetstar was kind of on the doorstep for me. I live in East Acton, and you know, Jetstar, they're just literally in Acton. And my uncle-in-law Smokey, he said, you know, he used to take me to that label when he used to buy records and take records there to sell. You know, he had a record shop, and he would go there, you know, for, you know, like, he would take records for them to release and also buy records so that he can have in the shop. You know, so I kind of got known to going into the reggae label. And I met the guy, Mr. Palmer. He was the head of the label at the time, and you know, kind of loosely got cool with him. And eventually, one day, I just walked in and said, I like a job. And they said, what can you do? I said, well, you know, I'm good with sales, you know. He said, okay, we'll give you a sales executive position. I was like, happy, man. I got a job with Jetstar, you know, this is a reggae label. It's so cool. You know, I mean, like, you know, got this job myself. It's a funny story with Jetstar. It was really interesting. I worked with them for a while. I mean, everything was running smooth for a while. And then next day, one day I came in, a guy came in, and they started seizing computers, like literally taking computers. Like, what's going on? They went into administration, literally right when I was working one day. I was like, you know, I was like, hold up. Am I gonna have a job? You know, they folded. I couldn't believe it. It was like, and they were legendary labels, so I didn't believe that that could actually happen, but it was happening right in front of me. And you know, I got my severance pay and all of that, you know, but it was just sad that it, you know, a job that I thought I'd have a long way to go with Jetstar, you know, and it's literally on my door. Going to be a long term thing. But anyway, it's good that it fizzled out because it helped me get back into being an artist. And what happened? The guy who was A&R Jetstar, he kept nagging me. He said, "You know, something about you know, do you sing?" And I was kind of like not really trying to talk about that for a while. But then he really, really got it out of me one day. It's like he had a big, big, brash Jamaican accent. You know, his name's D Lang, and his uncle's legendary in the whole reggae field back in Jamaica. You know, and D had this such a thick accent, but he would say, you know, he tried to talk to me and say, "You got, I know you got something in your brother." You know, it's like so patois, you know. And he kept nagging me. He said, "I'll go here in the studio." I'm like, "You know what? Yeah, I hear you, man, but I ain't trying to do it, you know." But eventually he did get me in the studio. And the record that we got done was sort of breakout record that kind of reintroduced me into music as a solo artist. It was an experiment between dance hall and R&B. You know, he had this producer called Alchemist, and they had a beat there that was just sitting there, and I kind of fused the ideas of 112 and R&B writing on the track, and it became known as I'd Like to Know. I was like, okay, you know, I was thinking of Mario, "You Should Let Me Know," "You Should Let Me Love You," that kind of idea, you know. But I was always listening to 112, and you know, Kevin Little had just broke out with, you know, his Turn Me On single. I tried to just kind of work where I'm at, and my head was around 112. It went in between that vein on dancehall. Yeah, when it dropped, I was like, whoa. And people said, "Yay!" You know, it's like 112 on dancehall. I was like, "Cool, I really appreciate that. It's a nice experiment." You know, I didn't really know where I was going at the time. Oh, and that was my first single that kind of let me sit in reggae, and because I couldn't write to calypso, I couldn't really. I mean, I wrote to calypso, but I rapped to it, you know. But I couldn't find an R&B bass in calypso to write love songs, you know, and I do know that when I wrote the album for New Creation, that love songs is kind of what kind of flowed out of me very easily. And you know, we did some experimental things, but the ideas that came from me, like, you know, it's all love related. You know, I love Marvin Gaye and, you know, and Michael Jackson and, you know, Curtis Mayfield. What I didn't find myself listening to was a lot of Bob Marley, but finally I found myself in reggae, and it's taking me down this, you know, reggae route.
So you released that single, and how then did that journey to the current day? So how long ago was that, and what was the next steps?
It was like, okay, where do I find myself going as an artist? You know, D was pushing, you know, it's like, okay, you know, you got to follow it up, you know, come up with some other ideas, you know. He was constantly trying to get me to work with other people and things like that. And then it came up, I can't remember who found the idea first, but the Geta Boys had worked with the single. And I can't remember the single name, but I remember bum ba da bum 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 ba da dun dun. Yeah. But I do remember the track was kind of looped from what Mark Morrison used for his single. I remember those kind of music was around and bouncing around, and I was like, okay, this is an R&B group, but I'm focusing on reggae here. And then somewhere along the line, the lyrics came to me, you know, sort of a dance hall type swing, and I came up with a single, Ghetto Girl, right? You know, Queen in the Ghetto was a single that came up, and I was like, whoa, I just wrote the song, got a kind of dance hall swing, but it came from a hip hop kind of bounce. You know, how do I get it to where it needs to go? Because it was a hip hop beat, didn't really want to work on a hip hop track. But somewhere along the line in my little networking swings, I met this producer called Livingston Brown, and Livingston Brown produced Maxi Priest. You know, the manager who I met in this seminar, he said he managed Livingston Brown and managed Maxi Priest. So I was desperate to work with either one of them. He came for me to work with Livingston Brown. I said I had a single that I, you know, song that I wrote. Livingston was, that was his sound. The reggae is what. So I was like, okay, so we went there with the single. You know, I had all the lyrics and ideas in my head. Ghetto Girls is amazing. It's a work of art now that I could keep on listening to. I remixed it over and over and over several times, you know, because it's just a song that's kind of, it's a winner for me, you know. And the way it came about, I'm really happy. It charted for me in the UK. And it's like years after I had it produced, it was my first charting single, you know, in the black music, in the urban music charts, you know. And you know, I was like really happy that I did that, because it was like it didn't date here that I produced it such a while back. And when I released it, it went, I think we got to number seven, top 10 urban music charts. And from there, I was like, this is my journey. I think, okay, I'm walking the route of reggae, and and R&B kind of, swing and stuff like that. I'd like to know. And then I had, Ghetto Girls. And then eventually what happened, I was looking for a remix of Ghetto Girl, and I've heard about a remixer called K Warren. I called him up and said, "Hey, can you work with me on a remix here for Ghetto Girl?" And he did amazing garage remix. Garage, still was a prominent music of the day, and garage was his field. And he said, "Yeah, I'll happily do it. I'm really happy with what he did." But to work with K Warren led to my next single, because he, being a garage remixer, that was what his trade was, But he had a single, he had a beat that he had lay about in his, his files that he never did anything with. And he said, "I got this track here, and I'd love it to, I'd love to show it to you, because you're kind of doing reggae, and I have no one else to show it to." I listened to it immediately. I fell in love with it. It came my next single called Loved Up. And by the time I did Loved Up, I had already, being a hustler I am, I hustled myself into working for Metropolis Studios, which was not far from where I lived. Became production executive for Metropolis. And in this complex, I mean, magic happens there. Rihanna recorded there, Mark Ronson records there, SZA Sisters, everyone, come there. Adele, they've mastered there, they work there. This is a mega complex of where talent happens, And I was happy to get the job. One of them networking nights, a guy called Winston Saylor comes across, my radar, and he just gives me his card. I followed him up. Next thing you know, Winston Saylor is the hit songwriter for Maxi Priest, who wrote Close to You, his biggest hit. Must be fate was met, I'm working on a single called Loved Up. I'd love to see if you, would like an input on it. Winston had like eight number ones to his name. Having somebody who could write, so well, it could only be amazing, to my credit. And I was like, yeah, he agreed. He was willing. He came down to the studio with K Warren, and then, we worked on the single. I'd already done a draft of it, and Winston gave his input. And it was one of the most beautiful pieces of work I've come across, Loved Up. I'm very happy with it to this day, Got great remixes of it. And yeah, so don't, Loved Up, Ghetto Girl, and I'd Like to Know, they were the first, pieces of work that kind of journeyed me, through the walk of reggae and R&B making, and kind of took me to where I am now.
So,
Right.
Kojo, you mentioned a whole bunch of different genres of music. You mentioned reggae, dancehall, hip hop, rap, R&B. So, is there any specific that is your favorite to create for, or it just happens in the flow of the moment that you decide, okay, cool, this is what this song is going to be about?
Like I said, I wanted to call myself, a reggae artist, right? Because a lot of reggae influences come around me, right? R&B, it easily rolls out of me, reggae, I don't work with every reggae beat that comes across my path. It has to kind of have the right components in it. And sometimes it does have to have an element of R&B that I really want to gel to, because a lot of people tried to see if they could get me to write to like a social type reggae, that conscious type listening. And I don't, it doesn't come with me. I see myself technically as a love man. I don't say that easily, because I'd like to think that I have covered some things that cross issues. But yeah, I do work a template of staying around Caribbean.
So that leads me to my next question. I know if I had to ask you this in 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 hours, I know your answer will be different every single time. I understand
Yeah.
that and I recognize that. But if you had to push play to five songs by other artists, once we've finished this conversation, what would those five songs be and by whom?
Marvin Gaye, start there. I love Marvin Gaye. What's Going On? Masterpiece, I think when I heard Marvin Gaye, I was revolutionized, with how it came together, the strings, the soul on the record, Not a record that I wasn't listening to as an artist, but I realized that he appealed to me. Of course, Bob Marley, right? And, jamming, I completely love. I love Michael Jackson. Greatest one for me that I could listen to. And maybe because the way Quincy wrote it, the lady in my life, yeah. Melodies, the way it worked. A last record, but Wonderwall from Oasis, breakout track. It showed another side to me that I didn't know appealed to me. I like rock. Oasis were the big thing at the time.
So, Kojo, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So, as a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say big up to Jethro Sharon for introducing me to you, Barrett. That's
Yes,
big,
absolutely.
big part of my career, the way we met. I'd like to say thank you to my wife, who's also been a big part of, you know, me keeping in music. She's my biggest advocate and sometimes my worst enemy. It strengthens me, you know. Smokey Joe has been a big part of, you know, my career. Eddie Grant, as much as I don't get to talk to him, he had a big, big influence in where I am now. Ian Riley, who was a manager who helped us out of Trinidad and Tobago, you know, and helped our group become visible. Forever thankful, even though he's not a manager in my life, he's still a good friend. And, you know, I'm thankful that he's a part of where I am now. Rip, who looked after us in New York, you know, his mother's Diane Stout. Winston Saylor, who's been a great pal and songwriting buddy. And my mother, most of all, my mother. I cannot get by without even saying thank you to Mom. She's been, you know, my biggest fan. My mother-in-law, yes, Jackie, you know, there's lots of people, you know, I'd love to mention.